The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from West Babylon, New York, this is Sports Talk 1240.
Well, good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to hour number one of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 19th day of November, Thanksgiving week. Our engineer Brian Graves is across the way. We have got a great show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we'll welcome in former New York Rangers left wing Ted Irvin. In the second half, we'll talk to the legendary former goaltender of the New York Rangers, Gilles Gratton, who has a new book out called Gratoony the Loony. So we'll discuss that with him. Sit back, relax, enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on GBB. We've got some great stuff ahead in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page titled Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look, and then you can click and give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at SportsTalk1240. And all past shows can be heard on our website at www.SportsTalk1240.com. Well, my first guest was a left wing who played 12 years in the NHL for the Boston Bruins, the LA Kings, the St. Louis Blues, and, of course, the New York Rangers. He had his best years for the Blue Shirts. He played on a line with Peter Stemkowski and Bruce McGregor. I'd like to welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Ted Irvin. Ted, good evening.
Good evening to you, folks.
Great to have you with us, Ted.
Always nice to be remembered in New York, my favorite NHL hockey club.
Outstanding. Okay, well, you were born in Winnipeg in Manitoba. As a younger player, maybe growing up, who were your favorite teams and players, Ted?
Well, at that time, it was the old six team.
Right, and right.
Being in Manitoba, it would be the Toronto Maple Leafs or the Montreal Canadiens. At that time, I believe it was the Toronto Maple Leafs that I had a jersey when I was a little guy.
Oh, okay, great. Any favorite guys on those teams?
Well, you don't remember a lot, but my name was Ted, so a lot of guys in my family called me Teeter for Ted Kennedy, the old Hall of Fame centerman for the Toronto Maple Leafs.
Gotcha, okay. Well, you played many sports when you were a kid, baseball, tennis, football, track, but of course hockey was your true love.
Yeah, like a lot of the Canadian kids, especially growing up in the prairies, being so cold out here in the wintertime, hockey was our pastime starting in November with the frozen creeks and the frozen streets and skating on the streets, so we all dreamed to be a hockey player of some sort, and I was fortunate enough to make it all the way to the Big Apple.
You sure did. Now, you played for St. Boniface, the Canadiens in the Manitoba Junior Hockey League. You did pretty well there. You wound up with the Winnipeg Braves by mid-season. And how was the junior hockey for you?
Well, junior was good. Like, again, when we start off in Winnipeg, we didn't have a real major junior team. There was four junior teams in one city. And at that time, the original six, the NHL teams owned the junior team. So Boston Bruins owned two teams in Winnipeg, St. Boniface and Winnipeg Braves. At 16, there was a scout in Winnipeg, and he signed me to what they call a C form with the Boston Bruins, meaning I belong to St. Boniface or the Winnipeg Braves.
Okay.
And that's where I got my start. Because the scout had seen me, and I signed with Boston that time when I was 16.
Okay. The NHL expansion draft, you went to L.A. in that, though.
Yes, I did, yeah.
Yeah.
When I was 19, I was supposed to go to Oshawa to play with Bobby Orr.
Uh-huh.
And the owner in Winnipeg wouldn't let me go because he'd bought me contact lenses that year and a pair of new skates. So I had to play one more year in Winnipeg, and I ended up turning pro that year, so I never had a chance to go to Oshawa to play with Bobby Orr. Then when I did make it to the Boston, it was the Boston Farm System, Minneapolis and Oklahoma City, and so I played 3 years in the Central League, and in Oklahoma City we won it 2 years in a row, and our goaltenders were Jerry Cheevers and Doug Favell.
Not too bad.
Outstanding hockey teams, Jeff Sanderson and Goldsworthy, And that year, 67, was the National Hockey League expansion, first expansion, and I was fortunate enough to be picked by Los Angeles Kings, 12th round, I believe it was, to get my opportunity to play in the National Hockey League.
Well, you did well out in California. They called you the baby-faced assassin. Is that right?
I thought I was a lover, but I guess that wasn't. Yeah, well, out in L.A., they had a tendency to come up with a lot of names, and Babyface was one of them, and the other one was Cool Hand Luke, and it was quite an experience out there. We were owned by Mr. Jack Can't Cook.
Right.
And we were followed a lot by the Hollywood people. A lot of the stars were in our dress room and that, and we had good crowds, not big crowds, but most of the times when Montreal or Toronto or any of the original six came into Los Angeles, there's more sweaters for the visiting team than there was for the Los Angeles Kings. And, yes, I got the nickname of the baby-faced assassin, and probably that was one of the reasons I ended up getting traded to New York Rangers. Emile Francis happened to be a game where I was in a fight with Bobby Plager and Noel Picard, two at once, and he happened to be at the game, and he wanted me and traded for me.
Yeah, you were sent to the Rangers. The Kings were in a state of flux. They weren't doing that well. So you came over to the Blue Shirts for Real Lemieux and Jua Whiting in 1970. And you played a defensive role at first, but then you went on the line with Peter and Bruce McGregor, and you got more ice time, seemingly, then.
Yeah, when I first got there, it was very intimidating. Coming from us, well, being in the NHL was intimidating as it was, because that's what you dreamed of all your life. Now you're playing in the biggest buildings against names of guys you've idolized.
And right.
When I got traded to New York, it was, you know, the late January, February, something like that. And I think I played 18 games in the Rangers. I only got one goal. I was kind of a flop, I think. And I always remember that summer going home and said, you know, saying to myself, I better work out because I'm not going to make this team. And when I got to the Ranger training camp, I think I was earmarked for the American Hockey League, but fortunately I'd taken real good care of myself that summer and got in great shape. And I saw a role I could play on the hockey club, which was defensive style, hit a little bit, and it just turned out that I was very, very fortunate. The Rangers, at that time, everybody respected the position you played, and I ended up with as a checking forward and scoring some goals. And then Stemmer got traded there to New York, and it just worked out that he and Bruce McGregor and myself seemed to click as a defensive-style line, but we right. also scored some goals. So we had a role in that club because we had the gag line, and we had Walter and Billy Fairburn and Steve Vickers in our line. Everybody had a role to play, and at that time the players, to this day, were still very close, had respect for each other and the roles we could play. So we found with Stemmer and Murdoch and myself that we could be the first line out or the last line on the ice and be very defensive-minded. And if the trouble started out there, we could also hold our own. So we found a niche. We were very lucky to be able to find that with the New York Rangers.
You sure did. We're speaking with Teddy Irvin tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I remember those clubs, Ted. I followed the Rangers very closely back then. And I believe the Tkachuk line was the Bulldog line.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Right.
Right.
Exactly. Okay. How about the Irvin Shuffle? Let's talk about that.
Well, that was, let's be honest, playing National Hockey League is very exciting. When I scored a goal, it was exciting. And
yeah.
For some reason in New York, I got this shuffle where I did a little dance. I stepped, did a little high-stepping dance, unbeknownst to myself, I saw it in the hockey cards. I guess I was so excited when I scored. I did this little extra dance, and all those things I did, the baby-faced assassin, the dance, all ended up in my hockey card, so it stuck with me all those years.
And if it's on a hockey card, it's got to be true, Ted.
Yeah.
Right?
Anything's in print, it's got to be true.
Exactly. Now, you had the five full seasons in the Big Apple. You were an outstanding team player. You were very popular off the ice, too. You won the Hockey Writers Players Player Award, and you did some great charitable work in the New York area as well.
Yeah, that was really fortunate. As I say, on that team, I was lucky enough to find a role, and The one year, the guys honored me with a player's player, which is really quite an honor to this day, be voted by the guys I played with, Rattels and the Parts and the Jackamans and all those guys. And Rod Gilbert voted as the guy that they, said he did a real good job. That was special. And then the New York Rangers was special because Dennis Potvin, I think, won it for the Islanders. And so that was nice to be, respected by both sides. I don't think I had a lot of problems with a lot of guys at that time. It was Hugh Delano was there and Wes Gaver. And I think the only guy that never really liked me was Stan Fischer. He called me a mediocre hockey player that never reached mediocrity.
Oh, man. That's rough coming from the hockey maven.
The hockey maven, yeah.
Yeah.
That was great for me at banquets. I used it lots. Don't get too cocky, folks. There's always somebody out there has an opinion. But I really, I was very lucky. I had a lot of respect for what I did. Playing in New York was the epitome of everything I did. When I got to St. Louis after my career was done in New York, because I had such a role there. The fans are so great. Even to this day when I go back, people are just terrific to me. So the reporters never did me bad, and if I played bad, I knew it too. And at that time, nobody really roughed you up in the press that bad.
No. That's true. Only the hockey maven had some rough things to say. Now, you played on that line with Peter Stemkowski and Bruce McGregor. Talk about their style of play and how that third line came into play.
Well, the style was every line has a role. And with Stemmer was a big bull. He was one of the big guys at that time. And he was just big and strong, so you knew Stemmer was pretty well straight up and down the ice, into the corners or out front, very solid, very strong man. And so you knew where he was. He was just a strong guy. Murdoch McGregor was very smart. He was almost like an analytical guy. He went on to be a coach and part of the Glenn Sather crew that went to Edmonton. So Bruce was very methodical and really understood the game. So he was more... he'd be in the right position more so than Stemmer and I would ever be. So you always knew if you made a mistake, Bruce was on the other side.
Uh-huh.
You knew you had it. And for myself, I think speed-wise, I was pretty quick, and I wasn't afraid to hit. And it was just a combination of the three of us that we could rely on each other. And in any sport, you have to rely on your fellow teammate. And with Bruce, like I say, we knew he'd be back there. He just had his man, or he saw where Stemmer and I were. So you knew automatically he knew where we were at. And with Stemmer, I got a lot of pushing and shoving, and I could always rely that Stemmer would be right there. We had a lot of scraps over the years, and I know Stemmer was right there beside me. I remember a fight I had with Jerry Cora up in Chicago and Madison Square Garden, and Cora just popped me in the head once, and Stemmer tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Let's get the hell out of here. He's too tough." And so he really helped out a lot. The other thing was we had a lot of fun on the ice, and that was important because Stemmer was really quite the clown, and so practices were loose with Stemmer. But he was also... he never shut up on the ice. He was always talking to other players on the ice. And I've never laughed so hard over the years with him and talking to Alex Delvecchio or Eddie Shack while we're playing the game. And he even taught me Polish on the bench and during the game, skating up down the ice. He'd be calling me in Ukrainian and stuff like that. So we got along well. But it was just one, we never were out of a lot of position. Nowadays, everybody flows all over the ice. We were up and down pretty good.
Yeah.
I think myself being a hitter, pretty fast, Stemmer being, both sides of the rink. Stemmer's a good goal scorer, and McGregor being the technical, methodical guy, just worked out to be a good line. We knew at the end of the game, if we were on the ice, we knew defensive, and none of us really screwed that up.
Yeah, great analysis, Ted. Ted Irvin with us tonight. Do you remember Skateland?
Sure do.
Yeah. My dad used to take me to the practices over there, and I'd wait for you guys to come out of the dressing room there, and I'd have my little pad and pen.
Oh,
and you guys were always great with the kids.
Well, we were lucky. Skate landlady, like at that time, Neil Francis, we lived over at Atlantic Beach, and he didn't want us going downtown all the time, so they had the rink at the skate land and everything else. And sometimes those rinks were just packed with fans.
Yeah.
And it was showtime, especially with Emil with that whistle. Because Emil never said a lot on the ice in practices. It was one whistle, two whistle, one whistle, and we knew you go this way, you go that way. And then all of a sudden, if there was a two whistle too long, we went, uh-oh, we're not skating hard enough, and we knew we were in trouble and that. Because he knew the fans were there to watch us.
Right.
But then able to walk out after to see all those people. I still got two of the greatest friends, friends of the family, the Valtteri family. They were there. I met them there at a practice, then at one of the banquets, the dinners, and we're still friends to this day. We got very close to people, and it was a responsibility of all of us that we just signed autographs. You know, Ranger fans were tough on us, and rightfully so at the right times. But to this day, they're some of the most loyal, wonderful people that I've met. That they are passionate for their game, and we didn't have the right to walk by them and not sign an autograph.
Great viewpoint, Ted, definitely. Now, on those Ranger clubs, you had a couple of Hall of Famers. I mean, you had the Cat, who's a Hall of Famer, Jean Ratelle, Rod Gilbert, Brad Park, Eddie Jockman, and then when Terry Sawchuk left, Villamur comes in and fills the hole quite nicely. Talk about some of the guys, the illustrious guys on those Ranger clubs.
Well, you raised some great names. I was just in New York for the New York Ranger Golf Tournament. They brought our 71-72 team back, and they honored the gag line. And,
yeah.
When I go to those meetings, Vic Hatfield just called me the other day, and Vic's very good at keeping us informed of all the guys. It hurts now because some of the guys are hurting physically, and it hurts to see the guys walking and some of their minds. And that crew, they stand out to me because we were so, so close, and it breaks my heart that Emil Francis, of all guys, doesn't have a Stanley Cup because he was the classiest guy. Of all the general managers, he deserved the ring more than anybody that I've ever met. And so as a team, they all had a role. Every guy was a different character with the defenseman. Rod Seeling was different than the other guys. And you don't get along with everybody on the ice in your dressing room, but during the game, you are a team. And that was the beauty of that club. We respected each other when we were on the ice, whether in Boston or Philadelphia, you stand up for each other. So I remember the guys. I'll tell you a story that's not a comfortable story for Jean Ratelle. To me, one of the quality, classiest men I've ever met. Uh-huh. I saw Johnny this fall, first time I've seen him in 20, 30, 40 years. That year I got to New York, I had that one goal in 18 games. When I went to training camp, I knew I had to make the team. So what I did is I figured I better hit somebody. And so in a squad game, who would I hit behind the net with? Jean Ratelle. Classiest, one of the best hockey players New York Rangers have ever seen.
Uh-huh.
He flattened me.
Wow.
I was so embarrassed. I went to my room after, knocked on the door of Jean Ratelle. He came in. I said, "Sorry, Johnny, I feel like a fool." He said, "Teddy, you keep doing that. We need you to hit. That's what we need in this club." And I told him that. He said, "I don't believe I said that." I said, "Johnny, if it wasn't for you, you give me so much support." And I'll never forget that 40, 50 years ago. That's the kind of guys we had. You know, like, you know, the gag line, scoring all those goals. Our line was still a big part of that club. Walter and Billy, so funny, and Sarge, Brad Park, Jules Wheeler may come in. Everybody had a role we play, and we respected each other, the role you played on the ice. And that made it so much comfortable that you weren't left to yourself as an island. I can go on about all the guys, the Brad Park coming up in the Bobby Orr ear and everything else. Mm-hmm. They just did a great job, too. And then Eddie and Whitey and Goal, and hear me using nicknames because that's what I remember everybody's nicknames and that. Eh? And I room with a guy like Billy Faber who never said two words, okay?
Yeah.
But we got along so good over the years that to this day he lives in the same province I do. We're still very, very close as people. I'm talking about the old days and that. And even our minor league guys, when they came up, they were part of the team. A year ago, Gene Carr came back. He said, "I never played with a bunch of guys as you guys and everything else." And so we were close as a team. Emil Francis, general manager and coach, you know, he was tough, stern, but he was like a dad to most of us. When I got traded from L.A. to Winnipeg, he said, "How much money you got in your pocket?" I said, $50. He says, "Here's $200. He says, "What are you going to do for a home?" I said, "I have no idea. Here's the down payment," type thing.
Nice.
It was special. It really was special. Those were great, great years because when you play for the New York Rangers, even to this day, everybody wants to beat the Big Apple.
Right.
And when you go on the road, doesn't matter what town you're in, the fans and those other teams step it up a notch. So you all had to rally together because you represented New York City.
definitely great sentiments in there. I remember talking about being tough on somebody, Ted. I remember the big whistle talking about Gene Carr saying he couldn't put the puck in the ocean. I was like, oh, man, that was a rough one.
That was. Well, we had those two young kids come up that year. It was Gene Carr and Larry Satrick, and they'd come out of Western Canada. You bring guys out of Saskatoon and out of Flin Flon and put them in New York City.
Yeah.
I mean, they're like two deer in a headlight, and they could skate like the wind. They were like two pups chasing each other around the ice, and we never laughed so hard because these kids didn't have a clue about New York City, yet they were part of us, and their skill level was so high. But it was tough to match your skill level living in New York and playing hockey, and they went on other places and played much better than they did in New York. But they had skills, I'll tell you.
They sure did. Ted Irvin with us tonight, Sports Talk 1240. You had some tough opponents, Ted. The Bruins had some tough guys on the club, but of course then you go down the turnpike to Philadelphia, and you got guys like Bobby Clark, Dave the Hammer. How about those guys?
Yeah, that was interesting. Like, Boston was physically tough.
Yeah.
Especially when you played in Boston. You know you're going to get hit, because that's when they first started with Teddy Green, and then they had Ace Bailey and Cash. Cash played with me, and Cashman played with me in Oklahoma City. They physically just kept on hitting you and hitting you and hitting you. And it was a smaller rink, so you knew physically it was going to be a bruising game. Then what happened was when you come in with Philadelphia, it was going to be a fighting style.
Yeah.
So that they were going to beat you in the alley. And it started just even pulling into the old Spectrum with your bus. They would love to rock your bus. When you skated on the ice, they had no overhang when you came out of the dressing room. So the beer and the popcorn was pulled on your head.
Oh,
warm-ups, you know, I always remember Stemmer and Moose DuPont bumping each other at center ice and the whole building going, oh, we're going to have a big brawl before the game. And the referees are watching from the corner of the rink, and you knew it was going to happen. And that's where you had to have the guys beside you if you weren't going to survive. But the Philadelphia ones, they bring guys up. We'd bring guys up for the minors, and so you just had to stand toe-to-toe. But with Stemmer, like I said, he'd be yapping out there. If we got out against Bobby Clark, Stemmer would just say, okay, Bobby, we're coming after you. And they'd always put Zaleski and Schultz with them, and they just Bobby'd step back and say, okay, boys, you want to go? Away you go. And we'd just say, oh, no, we're just kidding. Have a nice day, guys, and everything else. And, I remember the first game in Madison Square Garden as an exhibition game, and Schultz was called up from the minors, and he grabbed me, and he said, Irvin, I'm up from the minors. I'm going to make a reputation. I'm starting with you.
Wow.
Yeah, and I just said, why me? Grab some of those other guys over there type thing, you know. And those were tight. But I found that at that time there were certain clubs, it was physically, like St. Louis, they just kept on hitting you. Some of the guys, you knew some of the teams, the guys played a little tougher on the road than they did it, or a little tougher at home than they did in the road. And then, but you go in Detroit, they had guys there just to agitate you and hit you, and then you had the big guy, Gordie Howe. That one elbow from him was a sorry about that, sir. And so the Boston guys, that was the best rivalry we had.
Yeah,
because it was just home and away. Because they like Johnny McKenzie was there at that time, and he was chirping all the time, and played a tough game, and so it was, you knew when you went into certain games what the style was going to be. So you just had to be ready and jacked up for it.
Exactly. Now, how did you feel about leaving the Rangers and getting traded to the Blues? You went to the Blues with Burt Wilson and Jerry Butler, and J.D. John Davidson came over to the Rangers. It had to be a little bit of a shock.
Yeah, it was. We had, you know, like with any sports, you know, we went to the Stanley Cup that year, lost in the sixth game, and you always think you're going to get back, eh? And we never did. And when they started dismantling the club, you know, it really hurts to see your teammates go. And then we got traded to St. Louis, and yeah, it hurts, but you don't know till you get the other city what it really meant to you to be with, in this case, New York. I mean, I went with good guys, and St. Louis were good guys, but it was never the same team concept as what the New York Rangers were. The role we had, we never found a role there. When I got to St. Louis, where you got 26 goals when you're Irvin, you can score goals. No, I was more the defensive, throw in some goals once in a while. So I never found my place in New York. or in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. New York for me was the epitome of my career. It only took a couple of years in St. Louis. I just knew mentally I was finished. And I remember playing against the Islanders, and Clark Gilley clocking me in the back of the head and cut me over stitches. And I remember skating by the Islander bench and them laughing at me. Well, that never happened when I was with New York Rangers. I just knew I'd lost my spark and my effectiveness to benefit a team. So it hurt me. It took me a couple months after I got to St. Louis to realize this is not who I am. I'm not this style of player. I'm not the guy that's going to be the top, you know, 3 or 4 point getter on that team. And I don't have a role here in St. Louis. And I never had the closeness with players as I did in New York. So it hurt. And so my son was at that time 7 or 8, and he'd come back to Winnipeg. In those days, you couldn't stay down in the States. You had to come back home. And he said to me, Dad, could you stay home 1 year and teach Kung Fu? Because I'd taken Kung Fu in New York. Teach Kung Fu in Winnipeg so I could stay home and play with my buddies all year. And I knew my day in the sun had been gone. It was his turn to grow up and live in one place in that, eh? So it hurt, but I didn't realize at the time, because you go in there, oh, we can do this, we can do this. But then I just realized, well, I'd given my heart to the New York Rangers, and I just didn't have much left for St. Louis.
Right. Now, people were asking me this week, how did you find Ted Irvin? So I explained to them, I said, his son wrote a book. I tried to get his son on the show. It didn't work out. So I asked his son, how can I get in touch with your dad? And bingo, that's how I found Ted Irvin. People don't know, you don't know who his son is. His son is Chris Jericho, you know? And they go, get out of here. I said, no, that's how I found, I'm more excited to have Ted on this program than I would have had Chris.
Oh, that's nice of you to say. Yeah, no, I'm very, very proud of Chris. He's, as you know, wrestling's the last honest sport left, and everything else is fixed, but Chris has made a career of two things, music and wrestling, which he wanted to do when he's 15 or 16, and how many people get to live their dream. He's very, very dedicated, very, very smart businessman, and he's living his dream right now, and he's done very well for himself. Absolutely loves hockey. He's played in that Christopher Reeves tournament when that was going on in Madison Square Garden. Loves to skate, still goes to the games in Tampa, and big fan of the old Winnipeg Jets.
And, uh-huh.
So hockey's in his blood, but he's living his dream with these other careers. Maybe that's where he got his dancing moves, because he was on Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah.
Maybe he saw me score a goal, and I did my dance after the game, or after the goal. Maybe caught into my moves. I had to have some kind of role to play in that show.
Definitely. Dancing with, we've had a couple of guys from Dancing with the Stars on the show. Avery, Meta World Peace from the NBA,
right?
And Amy Purdy, the Olympic snowboarder.
Right.
So yeah, I'm no stranger to Dancing with the Stars. I'll never make it, you know. But that's
if the phone call ever comes, you'll be shocked and you'll be scared.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Teddy Irvin, it's been an honor and a pleasure speaking with you tonight. I thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night to be with us.
Well, I can't thank anybody and everybody in New York for remembering me. It was a big part of my life. I speak a lot right now on a Christian side of things. I'm a big part of things that are putting your life to be molded. You know, New York is one of those special places where I became a greater and better person because of my experiences in New York. And I just really appreciate you guys remembering and still supporting great sport, especially the New York Rangers.
We're happy to do so. It's our pleasure. And thanks for signing that autograph at Skateland for the little kid so many years ago.
Well, I'm glad I signed it, and thank you for asking me.
No worries. Have a good night, Teddy. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, thanks again, though.
Take care. Teddy Irvin, folks. Next up, we'll talk to former Rangers goalie, the immortal Gilles Gratton. Stay with us, folks.
You are listening to Sports Talk 1240 on Long Island's AM 1240. WGBB.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Want to advertise your business on Sports Talk 1240? Place an ad on sportstalk1240.com and run a radio commercial during the show every Sunday night here on AM 1240 WGBB. Our rates are very affordable. We'll even produce the radio commercial for you. Just head over to sportstalk1240.com and fill out the Contact Us form and let us start promoting your business today.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gustbuster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit Gustbuster.com and get your Gustbuster today.
Stay connected to Sports Talk 1240 by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Sports Talk 1240.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, folks, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on GBB in Freeport, Long Island, New York. I'm Bill Donahue. I'll be with you for the next half hour. I hope you're enjoying Sports Talk 1240 tonight. This might be my last show for 2017, so stay tuned to the website to be sure about that. New York Giants finally win a game today. Oh, it just proves, folks, that even a blind squirrel finds an acorn once in a while. So there you go. My next guest was a goaltender who played for the Ottawa Nationals and the Toronto Toros of the World Hockey Association and the St. Louis Blues and, of course, the New York Rangers of the NHL in his six-year career. He's got a new book out titled Gratuny the Loony, The Wild, Unpredictable Life of Gilles Gratton. Along with his personal, he's famous for his great goalie mask that we remember. We share the same birthday, July 28th. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Gilles Gratton. Gilles, good evening.
Good evening. How are you?
Great to have you with us.
Jackie Onassis was born on July 28th, too.
Exactly. Bill Bradley, there's a couple of guys. Now, growing up, Gilles, who did you root for? What teams? Who were some of your favorite players?
I would say Montreal Canadiens was my team. You know, when I was younger, that's the only thing we had on television. When I was in the 50s there, we take a bath, me and my two brothers, and then they only showed the game starting in the second period back in the 50s.
Wow.
So we take a bath, and then we'd sit in front of the television and watch the second and third period.
Outstanding. Who was, when you were playing, who was the first famous player that you met or encountered that really made an impression on you?
That I played against?
Yeah, or with?
Bobby Hull, maybe.
Okay. How did that work out?
Well, I played against him in the World Hockey for 3 years, and he had an unbelievable shot, so he was... I had a white mask at one point. He took a shot, hit me in the chin, broke my mask, and
wow,
it was very difficult to stop. So and Marcel Dion too. I was really impressed with Marcel Dion, especially in junior. I played against Marcel Dion in the juniors and in NHL. He was one of the best I've ever seen.
Well, you were drafted in the fifth round of the 72 NHL draft by the Buffalo Sabres. Instead, you chose to go to the World Hockey Association. Why'd you make that decision?
Just money, because when Buffalo drafted me, they offered me $5,000 to sign and $8,000 my first year and $10,000 my second year for a grand total of unbelievable amount of money, $23,000 for 2 years.
Right.
And when the World Hockey came in existence in 72, the Ottawa Nationals offered me $20,000 to sign, $25,000 and $30,000, so $75,000 for 2 years. And Punchimlack offered me $23,000 for 3 years. So what would you have done, eh?
Exactly. Yeah, I hear you. Now, you moved with the team to Toronto. We had the 74 Summit Series. You were selected as Team Canada's third goalie. How is it playing in that international series, especially against the Soviet Union?
Well, I was not selected. They only picked two goalies to start with. They picked Cheevers and McLeod, and then Billy Harris, who was coaching the Canada team and was my coach in Toronto, called me 2 days before camp, and he said, "I'd like to have you as a third goalie as an entrance, you know."
Right.
So I said, "Okay, you know, be fun, go to Russia. I won't play third goalie, no pressure. Have a good time, you know." And as soon as I get to Edmonton, Billy Hunter, who was the manager of the Team Canada, called me in his office, and he told me that he didn't want me on the team, that that was not his ID. So I told him, F off, you know, and whatever. I said, I'm out of here. I'm going back to Montreal. I told him a lot of bad words, but I won't say them on the phone.
Sure.
And I said, get lost, whatever, and I was going to go back to Montreal, but Billy Harris came to see me in the room, and he said, you know, oh, yeah, and Billy Harris told me I had long hair and beard. He said, shave your beard and cut your hair. I said, no way. But then Billy Harris came to see me in my room, and he said, you know, stay just for me, because I really like Billy Harris. He was kind of a father figure for me. So
right.
he said, just stay, just shave your beard, cut your hair, and just keep your mustache. You know, I said, okay, I'll do it for you.
Nice,
so,
okay.
In the fifth game, so I didn't really practice hard at all. I was just like a passenger, but then the Cheevers was at a pull groin, and the McLeod got bombed in the third game. So Billy Harris asked me to play the fifth game in Moscow, and I said to him, I said, listen, that idiot Hunter told me I wasn't going to play, that he didn't want me on the team, so I didn't practice hard. I'm out of shape, so I'm not going to play. But Billy Harris wanted me to start the fifth game in Moscow, but I was out of shape. I had been drinking and partying and, you know, having a good time, you know, and
right.
No way I was going to play that fifth game.
Exactly. Now, 75, Gilles, you jumped to the St. Louis Blues, and later on the following year, you wind up with the Rangers splitting time with J.D.
Yeah, but I had a five-year contract in Toronto. I only played the 1 year, and the reason why I left is when they fired Billy Harris, I got really pissed off.
Right.
And I started to act really weird, and finally... when Bassett, the owner of the Toronto Toros, called me to, you know, go to his cottage and then mend things up, I said, no, I'm not going. I was really angry that he fired Billy Harris. And so he sold me to St. Louis. And if you read the book, I met Gary Young in the hotel lobby there in Montreal during the draft of 75. And I didn't know he was going to be the coach because I knew him from my junior days in Oshawa.
Ah, okay.
So I go into the lobby, and he says, how about coming to St. Louis? Are you happy? I said, no, I'm not happy. I don't give a shit, you know.
Right.
And I don't care. And I could see his face turn really white, you know. I said, what's his problem? And as soon as we get to the sixth floor, we get up the elevator, and he's right behind me, and then they tell me that he's my coach. So that was really an awkward moment. So from that moment on, he gave me a hard time, and I was going to punch him out in the one day in practice in the room, he told me that I let the guys down in Long Island, and Eddie Johnson had to go in, and we got bombed 8-0. And the next day, I just wanted to punch him in the room, and the Plagers held me back, and I just left and never came back.
Yeah, I don't blame you, Gilles. Gilles Gratton with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240. You're known definitely for the mask. How did the mask come about? Was it the astrological sign that we have, Leo? Or
it's just that I had we're flying back to New York and after a road trip in early January of 1977. On the plane, I was reading a National Geographic magazine, and in the magazine there were like pictures of different animals, and what attracted my attention was a picture of a tiger. So I got the idea of having a mask made from that picture. So I stole the magazine from the plane. I called Greg Harrison, and who had made a few masks for me when I played in Oshawa and in Toronto. So I asked him if it was possible to make a mask from the picture of a tiger. Well, yeah, he said yes. He asked me to bring the magazine next time I was in Toronto, so which was the following week, I guess. And when in Toronto, I went to Greg's house, showed him the magazine. In the magazine, there were also a picture of a lion. So since I'm a Leo in astrology, we decided to have the mask made from that picture.
Okay. Now, is it true, Gilles, that you used to growl at players on the ice with the mask on?
Yeah, usually I did it for the first, like, maybe 4 or 5 games, and that didn't really scare them. That made them laugh, I guess.
Yeah, why not? Now, did you once tell your teammates that you were reincarnated and that you had been a soldier in the Spanish Inquisition?
Well, what happened is that I had a kind of a feud with Phil Esposito, kind of an argument with Phil Esposito. So he was king of the room, and I don't know if you read the book at all, but in the book, the story is there. I told Esposito to get lost and on the ice, and I was gonna, get a little nasty there in the room with him. And so the next day, I was living with Rod Gilbert there, and Rod Gilbert told me they had a meeting, and I wasn't gonna play for the rest of the year. So I said, that was in February, I guess.
Yeah.
So he told me I wasn't gonna play for the rest of the year. So I said, okay, I'm not gonna play. So when Ferguson came to see me one day to play, and since they told me I wasn't going to play, so I told them that I had an injury from my past life and I couldn't play. And then the next time he came again to ask me, I said, no, I can't play tonight because my planets are not aligned.
Right, yeah.
I was playing with his head, really.
Yeah. Who would want to play with the planets not aligned? I understand that completely.
No, that was a joke. I was just making fun, but I guess they took it seriously.
Yeah. Sure. Gilles Gratton with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Now, you of course you believe in reincarnation. Things happened in your previous lives. There was an interview with Marv Albert that the nickname "the Count" came about. Describe that for us.
Oh, the Count was we had a party at the Roger Gilbert's house at Halloween, and I was dressed as a Spanish count, So everybody started calling me the Count, but I was really a count in the past life, so that's why I dressed as a count. And that night, I remember somebody put hash in the cake, and everybody was just stoned out of their heads, and they didn't know what was happening to them. That was really funny.
Yeah, that must have been a great party. Yeah,
especially to see John Ferguson being very, very friendly and just like dancing, and being, because he was really always not friendly and very, very straight faced. But that night, he had that cake, and he was just stoned. He didn't know it.
He was all over the place. Yeah, that's a great story. Now, did you think being a hockey goalie was punishment for stoning people in your past lives?
I believe so.
Yeah,
because I didn't really want to be a goalie as I grew up, but I was just put into that position because Dan Bouchard, who played with Atlanta and Quebec Nordiques, was our goalie when I was peewee. And if you read the book, you'll see a picture in there, a softball team there, and there's Dan Bouchard, my brother, and Norm, myself, three little guys that played in the NHL. We played in the same softball team. So Dan Bouchard was from my hometown, and he was our goalie, and I was playing third line. And I was a forward when I was a kid. And when the coaches decided that he had to be go Bantam because he was too good for us, they had to put someone in the net, so they put the smallest guy, which was me.
Yeah.
And they put me in the nets. But up to midget, I played goal and I played forward.
Okay.
And when the year I played midget, I only played the 1 year, I played as a goalie. But when I played for my parish, I played as a forward.
Okay.
And when I played junior B, I hardly played. And it's just strange circumstances. Just a scout from Boston following me when I was a kid. And he got me a contract in Oshawa. But when I finished my junior B year, I didn't want to play anymore. I didn't really pay attention to hockey. But I got that contract. I went to Oshawa, played 3 years. And it seems that hockey was following me. I was not following hockey. Hockey was pushing me into it.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I guess you could say, Gilles, that frozen pieces of rubber being slammed at you at 90 miles an hour, it's probably as close as you can get to getting stoned to death in today's day.
Yeah, I hate it to practice in the morning. I hated the cold arenas because our equipment was, not very good, and the puck hurt.
Yeah.
The puck hurt, every time, and you had to get warmed up. It took about half an hour before you got warmed up, the body warmed up and warm because the arena were cold. And I just hated that. I hated practice. That's how I got in trouble with Esposito, because I was just leaning on the board the whole time we're practicing. And he asked me, you know, why I wasn't practicing hard. I told him I had too much talent, and then we got in an argument, whatever. But I hated practice. I hated to practice in the cold arena in the morning. That was the worst.
Yeah, I can imagine. Now, you're also a great piano player.
Well, not really. I play piano since I'm, you know, my mom bought a piano when I was 15 for my brother who was a singer, and I just started to play, and I've been playing since. But I'm 65 now. I have arthritis in my fingers, so I'm not.
Yeah.
I haven't played in a couple of years. I played the other day for that show there from Mark Rosen. I was on a New York show the other day. 3 weeks ago, and I played piano, you know, and I play Let It Be because it's easy to play, you know, it's
right.
Just chords, but I can't play fast anymore.
Okay. Now, you once refused to play because the moon was in the wrong place.
Yeah, that was my excuse just to make Ferguson angry.
Well, that wasn't hard to do. Ferguson was kind of a red ass.
Yeah, he was always angry. He seemed to always, even when he talked to you, he always seemed to be angry.
Exactly. Now, you liked hanging out naked after practices.
No, I only did it once in Toronto because I asked the trainer for we used to play street hockey where I used to live with Wayne Dillon in Toronto.
Okay.
And he had two brothers and that played one. Gary played in the NHL and Brian played in junior. And the three of us and the kids in the neighborhood, we used to play street hockey. So I asked the trainer for, you know, a dozen sticks for the kids, and they said, well, if you skate naked on the ice, he says, I'll give you the sticks. So I went on the ice just with my skate and my mask.
Nice.
And I got the sticks for the kids.
Good. Yeah, that worked out.
Yeah.
Now, talk about John Davidson and how it was hanging out with him.
I didn't hang out with him.
No?
I hung out mostly with McEwen.
Okay.
Murdoch and Greshner, but JD was a great partner, like a great, how would you say that? I loved to be with him, you know, as a goalie. He was a great guy, just always friendly, and he was a great guy. But
right.
I didn't hang out with him because he had his wife, you know.
And,
me and McEwen, Greshner, and Murdoch were single guys, so we used to hang around together.
Sure, exactly. Now, back in the Spanish Inquisition, you were just a simple soldier. You weren't a knight or anything.
No, just a soldier. A
right.
Soldier, yeah.
And how were you killed?
Oh, just a these a gun with a like a spear. You know, I just got through the gut.
Yeah, that's certainly the way to go. Yeah. Now.
Yeah.
The book, again, Gratuny the Loony by Gilles Gratton, it's out. You can get it from Amazon. Fantastic book with some great stories. Why did you decide to write the book now, Gilles?
Because I'm 65. I'm not rich. And I've had two families. I have a 42-year-old daughter.
Okay.
And in my second marriage, I have a 19-year-old boy, William, and a 17-year-old daughter, Charlotte. And it's time for university, and I don't have the money for it.
Ah, good point.
So that's the only reason is to get the money to pay tuition fee for university.
Certainly.
That's
your favorite,
the only reason.
What's your favorite story that you have in the book?
My favorite story, wow. There's a lot of stories in there.
Okay.
You mean my favorite story?
Yeah.
I like the one about the... telling the St. Louis coach that I didn't give a damn about playing hockey, and his face, he almost passed out when I told him. That was a good story.
Now, you had a lot of illustrious teammates. Who do you consider your best teammate?
Boy. Oh, one thing I want to say, my best story is not in the book.
Oh, okay. You want to tell us?
Yeah. We had a meeting with John Ferguson in, I think it was in Atlanta, and we were on the losing streak. And Fergie told us, you know, everybody has to talk, has to, you know, let things out. What's wrong? So everybody was, one by one, we're all talking. When he comes to me and I say, Fergie, everybody hates you. And he kind of looks at me and then he starts to laugh. That's the spirit.
Yeah.
And that's not in the book.
He wasn't taken back or anything? He just laughed?
No, he started to laugh and said, that's the spirit, that's what I want, you know? And
yeah.
It's not in the book because I had forgotten about it, but Wayne Dillon told me that story a few weeks back.
Yeah. Oh, the great John Ferguson, the late, great John Ferguson.
So my best teammate was Mike Amodio.
Okay. Why is that?
Because we played in Oshawa together, and then we were roomies for 3 years in the World Hockey.
Okay.
And when I had my book launch in Toronto, he was there. He's a great buddy. He was my best friend in hockey.
Still friends. That's great. Who do you consider?
Yeah, he played in Winnipeg. He played in the World Hockey. Mike Amodio was a defenseman. He played in Winnipeg in the NHL, and he played in the World Hockey with me.
Okay. Who do you consider to be your toughest opponent?
Marcel Dion.
Okay. Talk a little bit about Marcel and about his game.
Well, Marcel Dion, he's the best player I've played against. We played junior. When I was, like, my first year in Oshawa, it was his last year in St. Catherine in the OHA, Junior League in Ontario. And I remember every time he had the puck, there was a chance, he had a chance to score.
Yeah.
And I remember the one night in Oshawa, the score was 4-4, and he had the puck behind the net, behind his net. And I look at the clock, there was like 15 seconds left. He took the puck, he came down the ice, went through the team, shot. He was really close to me. He shot, hit my blocker, and rolled in the net. And believe it or not, when he played in L.A. in the NHL, 4-4, we played the Kings in Madison Square Garden. I look at the clock, 15 seconds left, 4-4. He's behind the net, comes down the ice, and he deeks everyone. And then Van Nes right in front of me. He falls in front of me, and Dion takes a wrist shot. I don't see the puck. I can hear ding. We lose 5-4.
Oh, man.
This guy was so good.
Yeah, he's immortal.
Like underrated. I think he's the most underrated player ever to play hockey.
Certainly a great player, a Hall of Famer.
He's a great superstar.
Yeah, Marcel Dion. What do you consider your greatest memory in your career, Gilles?
Oh, my greatest memory. I would have to say my first year when we made the playoffs, and we were like out of the playoffs, and we won like 12 or the last 13 games. And I remember we were in Quebec that night, and they outshot us 51-16, and we beat them 3-1. And
wow.
We made the playoffs that night, and we had to beat them. We were tied, you know.
Yeah.
And we had to beat them to make the playoffs. So we beat them that night, and then we beat them the second night, and then we made the playoffs.
The Count of Manhattan is with us tonight, Gilles Gratton. We're talking about his great new book called Gratuny the Loony, The Wild, Unpredictable Life of Gilles Gratton. What's your favorite chapter, Gilles, in the book?
Oh, boy, my favorite chapter. I don't know. Maybe the Russian thing about Billy Hunter telling me that you didn't want me. You know, that Russia trip was, I like that one.
Back in the USSR,
I like the one too when I was a kid when my teacher asked us what was our, because in French here we have three names, you know.
The
Catholics, we have three names. And I told her that my name was Gilles Balloni Joseph Gratton, and she put me in the corner, and she called my mom. She said, that little shit, you know, he's making fun of me, you know, because my grandfather's name was Bellani Gratton.
And you told her Baloney.
So the way I said it, she saw I said Baloney, and she put me in the corner, and she called my mom, you know. I like that story.
Yeah, that's a great one, yeah. What do you do to stay involved with the game today, Gilles?
I work with Classic Auctions, which is a memorabilia auction house here in Montreal, and I'm still involved in the identification of pictures of the 50s and 60s and equipment, stuff like that.
Yeah, okay. Anything else you're involved in these days you want to tell us about?
No, that's it. I go to shows and I sell some of my books, and but that's only going to last for a while because, you know, it's only going to last maybe a few months, but that's it. Mostly that's all I'm doing, working at Classic and 65 years old and taking care of my kids. That's about it.
Sure. Now, do you want to tell the folks how they can get the book?
Well, Amazon, Chapters, Indigo, you know, any bookstore, I guess.
Right.
And if they don't have it, just ask them to order it.
And do you have a website you want to talk about?
Yeah, I have a website, but I don't really like it. The thing is, my book, I sell it $39.
Right.
Because their book costs me $13, and then it's $17 for shipping, so I only make like $8, $9, so it's more of a pain in the neck.
Yeah.
To do it, so I'd rather have people to go and buy it in the library, really.
Okay. Sounds
but
good.
If they buy it on my site, it's gratunideluni.com. I'll do it, but it, you know, like I say, I don't make much money. It's just a service, really.
Yeah, okay.
And, the site is gratunideluni.com.
Gratunideluni.com.
Yeah, but I prefer they buy it in the library.
Okay.
or Amazon.
Or Amazon, yeah. I checked it out on Amazon, folks. You can get the Jill's great book, Gratuny the Loony, on that site, Amazon. And they will take care of you there. Again, the title is Gratuny the Loony, The Wild, Unpredictable Life of Gilles Gratton. And there's some tremendous stories in there. You'll really enjoy this read. It's a quick read, and you'll enjoy it immensely, I promise you. Well, Gilles, it's been a pleasure having you with us tonight. I thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night to spend it with us.
Thank you very much, Bill.
You take care, and I'll be in touch with you.
Take care. Thank you.
Take care. The new book again, Gratuny the Loony, Gilles Gratton, folks. What I'd like to talk about now quickly is how much time we have, Brian? 2 minutes. Okay, we'll talk about the Hall of Fame vote coming up. I believe it's the first week in December. The Modern Era Committee meets to vote on people such as Dale Murphy, Steve Garvey, Marvin Miller, who's way overdue for election, I feel, to the Hall of Fame. A lot of the players today were drawing their salaries, owe a big debt of gratitude to people like Curt Flood and Marvin Miller. And we'll see who's elected there. Again, in January, the Hall of Fame vote will take place by the Baseball Writers Association of America. People who came up just short last time around, Vladimir Guerrero, Trevor Hoffman. We'll see how those people vote this year to see who will enter the hallowed portals of Cooperstown, New York. Well, that'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, Teddy Irvin and Gilles Gratton, my engineer, Brian Graves, and, of course, you folks for joining us. Stay tuned for hour number two on Sports Talk 1240. I'll see you next time. Until then, Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.